RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Good morning again for part two of my interview with US Fluoride Action Network attorney Michael Connett. If you didn't hear yesterday's part one interview with Michael, please do go back and listen to it on the replay section of the Reality Check Radio app or website. Because in that interview, US lawyer Michael Connett explains his latest court victory, which also explains the context of today's story. In it, he tells us how he forced the National Toxicology Program to release a previously suppressed bombshell review of scientific data showing fluoride's toxicity to children's brains, and then how a US federal court judge ruled on the basis of that review that fluoride poses an unreasonable risk of IQ loss to children and ordered the EPA to do something about it, which basically means that fluoride must now, excuse the pun, be dead in the water. Especially since also in the past few weeks, a Cochrane collaboration review of fluoride has also been published, showing that community water fluoridation has little to no effect, which of course makes us all wonder at how the fluoridation of our water here in New Zealand can continue. Michael Connett's journey to this point has made him one of the world's foremost experts on community water fluoridation. His research of the scientific studies and his depositions of health officials and Freedom of Information Act diggings reveal a long history of lobbyists promoting fluoride and health officials suppressing data, despite dire health warnings that threaten the health of children. In this part two interview, Michael takes us on that journey, explaining the history of fluoride and the way that the perfect storm of dental, sugar, chemical and bomb industries came together to promote it as an answer to tooth decay, and what made him take on this extraordinary journey, which in all likelihood will one day be a story told on film. So without any more explanation, here's part two of our interview with Michael Connett. Okay, so for the second part of this interview, I'd like to talk about fluoride itself. Where does it come from? What's the history? I've heard you talk about it, that it's part dental industry, part sugar industry, part industrial pollutant, and even part of the US bomb industry. Can you take us through where did fluoride come from, and also what is it, and perhaps put all this debate into context in maybe a historical way?
Right. So, you know, most people, when they think of fluoride, they think of the use of fluoride in dentistry. And they think of it in toothpaste. They think of it in drinking water to purportedly help their teeth. But there's another side to fluoride, and that's the industrial one. Fluoride was an industrial poison that caused very substantial liabilities for some of the largest industries in the world, like the aluminum industry, the steel industry, phosphate fertilizer industry, chemical industries. And I think it's important to have a full understanding of the fluoride debate, to have an understanding of the industrial side to the story. And if you go back to the 1930s, that was a time when there was a lot of concern in the scientific community about the toxicity of fluoride and the adverse effects that fluoride could be having on public health. And then in 1939, the first proposal to fluoridate water was made by a scientist by the name of Gerald Cox. Gerald Cox was funded by the aluminum industry and the sugar industry. And in a 1939 report that he based on his own animal studies on fluoride in teeth, as well as some human population studies, Dr. Cox wrote, quote, "The present trend towards the complete removal of fluoride from drinking water may need some reversal." So that's the first proposal to fluoridate water from a scientist funded by the aluminum industry and the sugar industry. And so I think large industries certainly welcome the perspective that, hey, fluoride is not some toxin that you want to, that can cause you a bunch of health maladies. It's actually something that helps and benefits your health. It reduces cavities. So I think it was very welcome news for industries that were in the crossfire of a lot of lawsuits on fluoride pollution. And you do see the footprints of industry in some of those in the early years of the debate.
So you bring up the sugar situation. Fluoride, we're told, is a health intervention which is supposed to help stop tooth decay, but also everyone also agrees that sugar plays a huge part in tooth decay. What you're telling us is that the sugar industry actually played a part in promoting this idea about fluoridation to draw attention away from its culpability, I suppose.
That's right. I mean, the historical evidence on that is pretty clear. You had the Sugar Research Foundation in the United States in the early 1940s began promoting fluoride as a way of preventing cavities. And the Sugar Research Foundation was not only promoting, but also funding studies to help promote the use of fluoride. And that remained the case for decades, where the sugar industry was very much encouraging and pushing federal agencies to focus on fluoride promotion as the sort of main way of dealing with oral health problems. And, you know, clearly there is a self-interest there for the sugar industry to put the focus on fluoride instead of, ooh, the sugar that is causing the cavities. So the sugar industry looked at fluoride, like other industries, as very welcome news, as something that they could latch onto and benefit from.
So does that continue, that sugar industry lobbying? Do you think that continues today?
My suspicion is yes, but as an attorney, I like documents, right? I like to have a document in my hand that I can prove something with, right? And we have those documents with the NTP. We know what was happening. We know what was preventing the NTP from publishing its report, because I have the documents that I got through the Freedom of Information Act request, right? I don't have those same type of documents to show the sugar industry's current role in influencing fluoride research or fluoride policy today. So that's a limitation that I have. Do I suspect it's going on? Yes. Is there a lot of historical documentation from the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s? Yes. But we just don't have access to the right document sets today to really elucidate that question.
Okay. Another one here is the fact that it was an industrial pollutant from the aluminum, steel, and fertilizer industries. The fluoride they put in the water here in New Zealand, I've been to the water plants where they put the fluoride into the water, and we've got footage of it in our RCR Fluoride in the Brain documentary. It's such a toxic substance that they have to house it in plastic tanks because it's too corrosive for metal tanks. And also, I noticed that anyone who handles it needs to wear a full hazmat suit. And there are also even showers right next to the plastic tanks where they connect the fluoride to the water supply, because this stuff is so toxic that if it touches the skin, they need to wash it off immediately. They can't just sort of run across the road to a shower block, for instance. Can you tell us about that? What is this fluoride and why is it such a toxic substance?
Well, fluoride is a very toxic substance, and you know, no one in history has ever gone and mined some fluoride from the earth for the purpose of fluoridating drinking water. Never happens. Instead, what you have is you have industrial fluoride waste that is captured in air pollution control equipment that is barreled up and then sold to water municipalities for fluoridation. It's a corrosive industrial chemical that we add to drinking water. And that's just the way it works.
But when I see it on the news, like when I went to research your trial and I looked on the American news channels, they were all talking about fluoride as a natural occurring mineral. And this is also how it's presented here in New Zealand as well, that it's natural and all we're doing is sort of topping it up.
Well, fluoride is naturally occurring, like other toxic substances like lead and arsenic and mercury. They are all naturally occurring. So the fact that something occurs naturally in the Earth's crust does not mean that the chemical is safe, does not mean that the chemical won't cause health problems. It just means it's a naturally occurring compound. The proponents of fluoridation, like you have noted, often will use the word mineral. And I think fluoride can be a mineral when it's complex with certain other compounds like calcium, but it's not always a mineral. Sodium fluoride, I don't believe, is a mineral. Sodium fluoride, in fact, has been used as a pesticide for many years. But the key point is that, yes, fluoride occurs naturally. It doesn't mean that doesn't make fluoride safe. And the fluoride chemical that we add to drinking water is not what any ordinary person would consider a natural product. It comes from air pollution control equipment of industry, usually the phosphate industry.
Okay, there's one other industry that I think this is more the headline grabber type one, and that was the bomb making industry. Can you explain what's the history around fluoride with the Manhattan Project and World War II and all of that?
Right. So in the early 1940s, the U.S. government was actively trying to build an atomic bomb, and it needed a chemical to be able to refine and enrich the uranium to take it from a low concentration, naturally occurring uranium to a high concentration bomb grade uranium. Okay, it needed to enrich the uranium. And the chemical that the U.S. government found that can do that is a fluoride chemical, hydrogen fluoride. Mm. And so the government had to use fluoride chemicals on a massive scale, a very high volume amount of fluoride chemicals in a bunch of industries scattered around the country that were helping to build the bomb. And as a result, you had the government was aware that this was causing problems for the workers handling the fluoride chemicals. It was causing problems for communities downwind and downstream of these industries using fluoride for the bomb program. And so the U.S. government was in many ways in a similar position as the aluminum industry and a similar position as the steel industry, namely, it was operating industries that had significant fluoride pollution problem.
Wow. It's so intricate, isn't it? And there's so many, it's a confluence of all these different industries. We've just talked about the dentistry, the sugar industry, the industrial pollutant angle, the bomb making angle. It's just so many different people all coming together on this one issue. So there's not one particular person or body that's driving this. This is a range of different groups all coming together on this.
I sometimes describe the early politics of fluoridation as a perfect storm. You had a number of interests that benefited from this program. And, you know, going back to the bomb program, I'll tell you, here's an interesting fact that just highlights the sensitivity of the fluoride issue for the federal government at that time. So the Food and Drug Administration was considering adopting a regulation that would have limited the amount of fluoride that could be present in food. And it was doing so in light of the use of fluoride pesticides. And the FDA was concerned that people were getting too much fluoride in their food from these pesticides. Well, the War Department, the U.S. War Department, which is now the Department of Defense, found out that the FDA was seeking to lower the acceptable level of fluoride in food. And the War Department went to the FDA to impress upon the FDA the government's substantial interest on this matter. And the War Department ultimately got the FDA to back away from this regulation because the War Department knew that communities downwind of these industries using fluoride chemicals for the bomb program were going to be contaminating the food at levels much higher than the FDA was considering regulating. So you see just the amount of interest that the federal government had on fluoride concerns was, you know, pretty notable. And I think pretty eye-opening to, I think most people would be surprised by it.
So they put a stop to the conversation because of the dangers of it. They didn't put a stop to fluoride because of the dangers of it. They put a stop to the conversation because substantial government interest. Does that ever surprise you when you hear things like that?
Yes. I mean, am I surprised by it now? Not so much. But do I think that people would be surprised by the amount of interest that the War Department took in little old fluoride? Yes, I think many people would be very surprised by it because it just doesn't fit any narrative framework that people have been told about fluoride. Like, why is the War Department, again, now the Department of Defense, why are they so interested in fluoride? Alistair, the first lawsuits against the bomb program were filed in the mid-1940s by farmers downwind of a DuPont plant that was emitting large amounts of fluoride due to its work for the bomb program, okay? And these farmers had their peach orchards withered and poisoned. They had their cattle poisoned. And the head of the War Department came and met with the farmers, like personally met with the farmers to help address their concerns, right? So it's like, that shows you the level of interest and concern that the U.S. government had on the defense side of things, that they'd send the number one head honcho to go speak with some farmers about fluoride.
The chief gaslighter of the army. Why isn't this issue front and center? Why aren't the media, the media just don't seem interested in it? It's beyond question now that there's at least an argument to be had, and yet no one wants to talk about it.
Right. So, you know, for many decades, unfortunately, concerns about fluoride have been stigmatized in a way that has led so many people to not want to touch this issue with a 10-foot pole, right? For many people, when they hear about fluoride and concerns about fluoride, the first thing they think about is Dr. Strangelove and crazy Colonel Ripper, who thought the communists were trying to invade our precious bodily fluids. And I think the proponents of fluoridation were, unfortunately, very successful in characterizing and framing the debate in a way that made it seem like you'd have to be a moron to be opposed to fluoridation. And I think that worked for a long time, and it still works. But I do think, thankfully, that in light of high-quality scientific research that's now coming out as addressed by the National Toxicology Program's report, that more and more people are kind of letting go of the cultural baggage on this issue and just looking at it, you know, with fresh eyes as how should we best handle this toxicant, right? And it's not about banning fluoride. It's about how do we safely and effectively use this chemical, right? And I think once you look at it, it's not about all fluoride. How do you, it's about this particular use of fluoride, adding it to drinking water has a lot of problems with it, right? And you don't, and that really shouldn't be a controversial subject. How should we best use fluoride? And so I do think we're making progress now in getting rid of some of that stigma, which has been extremely, I think, that stigma has been a disservice to the public discourse on fluoride and to our public understanding.
So even after all you've been through, all you've seen, you still think that there's a place for fluoride?
I think there's a place for fluoride in topical dental products where every family and individual has the right to choose whether to use that product, right? And it's not about, no one should be forced against their will to use fluoride. That I believe in, right? I believe in the right of informed consent, the right of choice. But I do think, you know, that there is a logic to using fluoride topically in dental products, in that there is evidence to indicate that topical contact with the teeth can have a benefit in cavity reduction. And for those who want to use fluoride in that way, then I don't see why the product shouldn't be available for them to use it. I personally don't use fluoride toothpaste, but I don't oppose it being available for those people who want to use it. I think it's a much more rational way of using fluoride than adding it to everybody's drinking water.
And I think that that's at least one place where I think everybody can perhaps, you know, if a discussion is going to start again, that perhaps that's a place where people can start the discussion alongside the discussion about sugar. I mean, all dentists agree that sugar is a curse for tooth decay.
Yeah, I certainly think that the government health agencies and dental trade organizations have done a disservice to the public in how they have approached and framed the fluoride issue. They have dumbed it down and simplified it in a way where the bad facts about fluoride have been airbrushed away, and all we are left with is a caricature of the issue. And that hasn't served anyone. So we really need a more intelligent and sophisticated discussion of how this chemical should be used, in what way it should be used.
How much interest have you had from the media since your court win against the EPA?
This has been the most media coverage we've ever gotten on any fluoride-related issue in my entire time working on fluoridation.
Okay, so there is mainstream interest in it now.
There has been substantial mainstream media coverage. I mean, it's not like on cable news on TV, right? We haven't gotten to that level, which is really where you need to get to really start breaking through to a much larger number of people. But like the Associated Press, Reuters, CBS, The Guardian, you know, Bloomberg, many print media organizations have covered the court's ruling, and they've done so in a pretty fair way.
Okay, to sum up, why do you care about this so much?
Well, I think I started I got involved with fluoride from the beginning, perhaps because I'm a fan of the underdog, and perhaps because I looked at this issue and I started reading about it and I saw, wow, there's just so many concerns here and it's not being addressed by any major organization. I saw it as a real blind spot. Like, you know, you have environmental health organizations working on pesticides, which is great because we need organizations working on pesticides and raising awareness about them, right? Well, fluoride is a pesticide. It's been used as a pesticide for decades. And it's a pesticide that we're actually adding to our drinking water. And yet no environmental health organization was working on fluoride. And so I just felt it was a blind spot and an area where where an individual could actually make an impact, you know, because it's not one of those issues which is super safe and everyone's working on it, right? It was an issue that very, very few people were working on. And that attracted me. And it kind of compelled me because I felt that I could use my skills to make a difference. And I hope that in the time that I've worked on this issue, I've been able to do so.
Well, just the story about how you made them release the NTP report, actually, that reminds me to keep some faith in the legal system. And it's so easy to lose faith these days, especially when you hear that evidence-based, truthful, scientific information is being suppressed and ignored by government agencies at a cost to our health. It's really such a deflating thought. And then I suppose they wonder why there's so little trust in our institutions today. But that's an aside. I suppose to see the fact that you've been able to force them to release it and acknowledge it, that gives me just a little bit of faith that perhaps our legal system and our democracies aren't quite in as bad a shape as perhaps some of us think they are.
Yes, you know, I was a law clerk for two federal judges after I finished law school. So I got to work in the federal judiciary in the United States. And my experience there was a very favorable one, because what I saw was logic and reason being used in a, you know, transparent way to analyze a set of facts. It was a very reason-based approach to handling controversies in front of the court. And so I, you know, by the time I was done working as a clerk for these two federal judges, of the three branches of the U.S. government, the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judiciary, I was very much of the view that the judiciary is the most competent, well-functioning part of the government, where reason and evidence can still prevail, right? Now, that doesn't mean it's perfect. There's certainly, you know, issues, right? But I experienced this same thing with this court case on fluoride. And it's one of the reasons I'm really, really happy to be an attorney. Because with this court case, we were able to just look at the evidence, right? And all the rhetoric about water fluoridation being one of the top 10 public health achievements and all this rhetoric, it had no place in the courtroom. It was just cotton candy. It was puff. It was puffery. It meant nothing, right? The court was interested in evidence. That's it, right? So you had this really like I was able to address this issue like in the ideal circumstance of having a judge who's just interested in what does the evidence show? That's it. And it was such a joy to have that kind of discussion as opposed to going to some like hearing before some policymakers who look at you with disdain. They don't care what you have to say. They treat you like you're an idiot. You have 3 minutes to say a few sound bites, right? And then they're just going to do whatever they wanted to do in the first place, right? And that's been a lot of my experience with sort of like these public hearings is I just don't feel like what I understand and my knowledge that I can use that in a way that actually makes a difference, because you're in more of a world of psychology when you're dealing with policy and trying to influence policymakers. It's a world of psychology. Like, you know, there's just a lot of like groupthink involved. There's a lot of tribalism involved. And so facts have much less sway in that forum. And that to me as a researcher, as someone who really takes seriously like the facts and understanding the facts, right? Having this venue, this forum with this court who only wanted the evidence and didn't want the rhetoric. It was a blessing. I really, really, really appreciated that so much so. And, you know, I think the result speaks for itself. We got, you know, with what the court concluded. But, you know, so yes, to go to your point, I think the court system remains a very important forum where reason, facts, logic can still prevail, and where the groupthink, tribalism patterns in our society just don't have as much of a footing. Not always. Sometimes that groupthink tribalism can influence a judge, right? But not in this case, not with fluoride in our lawsuit. So those are some of my thoughts on that.
Well, here in New Zealand, it's still unfortunately a case that the opinions of the health authorities seemingly weigh more than the findings of that NTP report. And it seems like they only have to repeat those same arguments that you've just mentioned, that fluoride's safe and effective and that it's the greatest health intervention of our time and all of that, that those are the arguments that outweigh everything else. But I suspect that together with the result of your court case and also the Cochrane review, that at some point the science will need to be addressed in this fluoride discussion. And I say discussion deliberately because, as you pointed out today, there are still possible uses for fluoride. So there is a discussion to be had, and I think it's important to acknowledge that. But in the meantime, what can people do? If they get those 3 minutes that you spoke about in front of their local council, what can they say?
I would say when we started fluoridation, it was supposed to be about the teeth and the teeth alone. Effects on the brain, neurotoxicity, IQ loss was never part of the equation. We did not sign up for that. So now that we have the National Toxicology Program, an esteemed authoritative body concluding that fluoride does reduce IQ, now that we have this federal court ruling, a detailed 80-page opinion, which was based on a thorough vetting of the science from the best experts on both sides of the issue. Now that we have that federal court ruling concluding that fluoridation poses an unreasonable risk of neurotoxic effects, now that we have this information, we really need to be moving away from this mass fluoridation paradigm. For those people who want to use fluoride, it's available in toothpaste and dental products, and no one's going to take away their right to choose to use fluoride in dental products, right? But an unnecessary risk is an unacceptable risk, and fluoridation of water poses unnecessary risks because we don't need to swallow fluoride. So I just think that that's some of the key points to make. It's an unnecessary risk now that we know you don't need to swallow it and it could be causing serious harm, including effects on the brain, effects on the thyroid gland, effects on our bones. It's time to move on.
Okay. To finish up, your organization is Fluoride Action Network. We can find that at fluoridealert.org. Are there any other places that that people can find your work and your information?
Yes. So I would encourage folks who are on Twitter to look at Fluoride Action Network's Twitter page because it's very active and keeping up with the latest news. Fluoride Action Network, you know, also has a website which has a lot of information. Another organization that was a plaintiff in our case is Moms Against Fluoridation. They have a website, and I'm on Twitter as well. I just joined Twitter actually this year, so it's kind of new for me. And, you know, I work for a law firm, Siri and Glimstad, and I do work on a number of health issues with a focus on informed consent and making sure that people have the right to choose what medical treatments they take.
Okay. And the other one here in New Zealand is fluoridefree.org.nz. Those are our people. And we've interviewed those people on Reality Check Radio a number of times, Mary Byrne and Kane Titchener, especially. Hey, Michael, thank you so much for your time today. This has been a real pleasure to have you on.
Well, thank you so much, Alistair. It's been great to be here.
That's Michael Connett, founder of the United States Fluoride Action Network and lead attorney in the recent court case in the United States where a federal court judge ruled that fluoride poses an unreasonable risk of IQ loss to children. And what you've just heard is part two of a two-part interview I did with him this week. And if you haven't heard part one, please do go to the Reality Check Radio website or app where you'll find part one in our replay section. Michael's story is one that should be echoing around the world. And I think it is. It should put a stop to community water fluoridation. It should also be vindication for anti-fluoride campaigners all around the world who've been called conspiracy theorists and flat earthers and many other nasty names in a campaign which has silenced critics of fluoride and suppressed evidence. And when I say that, I'm talking about evidence that it harms children's brains. And that's a special kind of suppression that perhaps we will need to talk a little bit more about in the future. But in the meantime, please do share these interviews with your family and friends, and even your local councillors and MPs in Parliament. Because in my experience doing these interviews and also making the RCR original documentary Fluoride on the Brain, which you can watch on the RCR website, most of the people who advocate for fluoride are actually genuinely unaware of the issues with fluoride. and by sharing Michael Connett's knowledge and the research of the NTP report and the Cochrane Collaboration Review as well, perhaps they can come to the same conclusion that a federal court judge came to in California last month. And perhaps then we can all save a few more children's brain cells in the process. My name is Alistair Harding, and this has been a two-part Fluoride special with US lawyer Michael Connett, only on Reality Check Radio. The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.